Meanwhile, you get a guy who's made bomb after bomb, and he keeps getting bigger and bigger movies.
Radio Drone. Welcome to another Thursday night. My style is always to announce that welcome to another Thursday night on this show. I'm Josh Hadley. With me, almost as always, is Cecil Trachtenberg.
Yes, my style is to always disagree with you because you're wrong.
We agreed on a couple of things in the past year, and that was scary to all of our listeners.
I know. It was very scary.
We just agreed on that. Oh, my God.
Oh, shit.
And as you can hear, Peter Bah Gajic is here as well.
Yes, Peter Bah Gajic, and Peter always stabs people in the eye. I think I stole that one from Fulci. Maybe it's the other way around, but that's my trope.
That's true. You know what my trope is? Adam and Eve promos. Go to adamandeve.com. Use the promo code DROME, and you will get 50% off of a single item, 3 free DVDs, a free clit bumper, and free U.S. shipping. Just use the promo code DROME at adamandeve.com. Now, tonight I want to talk about filmmakers who have a specific style to them or certain tropes that pop up in every one of their movies. This actually stems from just last night I watched Rob Zombie's 31. I don't want to talk about Rob Zombie too much because Rob Zombie will be coming up again in about another month and a half or so on this show. With 31, it doesn't matter whether I liked the movie or hated it. It felt like a Rob Zombie movie. From the opening frames, Rob Zombie's style permeates every frame of this, and that's one thing he's good for, is he branded himself with a specific style. When you think of a stylized director, which one do you go for where you immediately, maybe you can miss the credits, and within 10 seconds you can go, this is such and such director just based on the style this is shot in?
I'll go one in a bad way. I always know when it's a Paul Greengrass movie, is because the camera does not stop moving and it doesn't stop being edited for 2 seconds. That's in a case of like a bad thing.
You know what? That could also be a Dark Castle film from the early 2000s.
No, the Dark Castle films were not as bad as Greengrass. Like, they at least had some sort of continuity. And even on, like, the slower scenes where there was just dialogue, it's people sitting around a table talking, they at least will have the camera pan and move back and forth. This with Greengrass, even if there's somebody sitting there using a telephone, they have to shake the camera like there's an earthquake going on. Greengrass, that's in, like, a negative way.
Okay, then do you have a positive? Where you like the director and that style?
Kevin Smith. Because Kevin Smith has a lot of very long-held dialogue shots. You can tell right away. I mean, I would have already known that the movie was his because I thought, you know, but I think even if I didn't know, just the way that it's shot, there's a lot of static shots of people talking. There's a lot of, I mean, it's not, he doesn't kind of overdo his shots. Like, there's some directors who know how to, like, get, like, these really amazing shots. I'm not saying that he doesn't. Like, he's kind of showed his chops with movies like Red State and whatnot. But his signature is always going to be just very good, well-framed shots that usually go on, and there's a lot of dialogue within them. So it's like, he likes to let, you know, longer takes, and it's not 50 gajillion different cuts and different angles and everything. So that's, I'm gonna go with him because he's somebody who doesn't really get a lot of props for really growing as a director.
I gotta go with John Carpenter. I feel like, especially with his movies from the 80s and late 70s, you can always tell you're going into a John Carpenter movie the second it starts, because there's always the recognizable style of music. There's always that recognizable style of cinematography. There's a lot of shadow, yet there's always a lot of color as well. There's a great mood to it.
He loves those long Panavision lenses too.
Absolutely. His movies look gorgeous because of it too. Not any director quite has his style, his vibe. It's like I said, you always know it's going to be a John Carpenter movie the second it starts. You know, a movie like They Live or Escape from New York or The Thing, they always have these really cool, it's the way that his films begin. There's like this really cool build up, both with the soundtrack kind of starting out slow and low, and then it all builds up till it finally reaches its epic peak, which sets the pace for the rest of the movie. I've always really enjoyed that about his work, and I always will.
And I agree with you. When it comes to Carpenter, there's also something that he started to not do this as much later on, but early on, you'll notice how few close-ups he has. Because he loves that wide screen lens so much, you'll notice how many wide shots. Almost all of his movies are shot predominantly in medium shots, and that's a unique trait.
Yeah, like in, it's a good example of that for both Halloween and even for They Live. Like Halloween starts with the shot of a house and you slowly pan in. They Live, you got the shot of the city street and the alleyway under the bridge. It slowly pans until you see, Roddy Piper just walking up in the distance. It's this massive shot that shows so much scenery, like the coldness of the city, all the graffiti, They Live scrawled on the wall. And then you finally see Roddy Piper walking up as again, the soundtrack, like, slowly builds up like that, and it just like it gets you pulled into the movie in such a fucking awesome way. Like I love the way he starts his films and the way they transition and become more and more epic as the film goes along. It's just so great.
Well, then you have other filmmakers who, like I said, with Rob Zombie, he has a style. You immediately know this is a Rob Zombie movie. There's just something with the way the lighting, the art direction and whatnot. You also have people like Michael Bay. You don't need to know Michael Bay directed a movie to go, this looks like a Michael Bay film. He has the certain tropes he likes. Like, for one thing, everyone complains about Michael Bay as a filmmaker, but what they don't realize is he actually is a really good director. Look at how much he parallaxes, how much he always has something moving in the background of a frame. He's always implying something is happening off camera. His shots are never boring. He also likes that really low angle spin around an actor thing, which I think has kind of become his calling card. Because when you got somebody like Michael Bay, you also have somebody like Peter Berg. Peter Berg thinks he knows how to be Michael Bay, yet he doesn't seem to understand what parallax is, or to have definition or depth within a frame, or to have things moving in a frame. When you look at a movie like Battleship, that is such a Michael Bay wannabe movie that you're like, he's trying so hard to be Michael Bay.
Oh, God. I mean, if you were to watch Battleship, like shortly after seeing Transformers, you would think it was actually not only Michael Bay, but that it was another Transformers movie. The color scheme, the robots from out of nowhere, like the camera styles, everything really, really aped Michael Bay. And
except he didn't understand why Michael Bay's films visually work.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Michael Bay, for like as much as people give him grief, man, he knows how to make some beautiful shots. Like I really I only have a problem with Bay, like his ego aside, I only really have a problem with Bay's Transformers movies. I genuinely like The Island, Bad Boys.
Bad Boys 2 is one of the most visually beautiful films I've ever seen.
Yeah, the only thing that I have a problem with Bay is that his movies tend to go on a little too long. Like they could definitely stand to trim a bit, because they usually, they just go on for like 3 hours and they could very well have gotten their point across in two.
The entire last half hour of Bad Boys 2 didn't need to be there.
I love Armageddon, but Armageddon has 15 endings. And it doesn't need 15 endings. They really could have, trimmed it down a bit. But his stuff is always just visually, amazing. There's always stuff happening. There's always beautifully shot. There's great camera angles. The guy has a phenomenal eye. And the thing was, he got his start in music videos because of that. And when he brought over a lot of his music video buddies to do the Platinum Dune things, the thing is, the studios were looking at it, well, we got Michael Bay and these other guys are going to be just as good, and it's like they're not seeing why, like not everybody has that skill.
Because Cecil, one of the things is when you look at his music videos, like the Divinyls' I Touch Myself or Meatloaf's I'd Do Anything for Love But I Won't Do That, they feel instantly like Michael Bay, to the point where it's like he brought his music video skills to film. In one of the rare cases it worked.
Yeah,
that doesn't happen often.
No, it really doesn't, because if you look at all the other Platinum Dunes movies, they suck. Like, none of them really have the skills that Bay does.
Definitely a lot of filmmakers, not just him, but yeah, all the Platinum Dunes guys that he brought in, all his, like, music video buddies, and just other, like, action-based filmmakers are trying to ape that style. Like, the over-color-corrected look, the very orange skin, trying to make it look like there's always something going on in the background. But yeah, nobody does it quite the way Bay does. And yeah, people can talk as much crap about him as they want. You know, I myself detest the Transformers movies, but he's got movies that I can watch over and over again.
The Island is great.
Until the day I'm dead. Yeah, like, I love The Island, The Rock. Pain and Gain is a movie I watch, like, almost endlessly. Yeah, I really love his style. And maybe he seems like a bit of a shyster as a human being, kind of like a used car salesman filmmaker, but you gotta hand off some credit to the guy for knowing what works financially and for really knowing, like, how to set up a shot and use color and use, like, dynamic angles. Like, his movies kind of are known for that trope of the Michael Bay shot, which is that, like, low angle of the lead character and it pans across as they, like, stoically look off into the distance. And it's like, make fun of that all you want. It looks f***ing cool. It's absolutely just an awesome, like, hero shot. Like, it just looks badass regardless of what actor you use it for. Like, even Nicolas Cage doing that in The Rock looks badass because it's like, it's such a cool shot.
What about someone who his style waned, and that would be like Quentin Tarantino. I recently watched From Dusk Till Dawn, the original from 1996, for the first time since 1996 again last week. And it struck me as how much that movie feels like a Tarantino movie. And yeah. then I started thinking Django Unchained and Hateful Eight, they don't feel like Tarantino movies. And then I looked back at like Reservoir Dogs and Jackie Brown and Pulp Fiction, and I'm like, even Kill Bill, those all feel like Tarantino movies. For some reason, it seems like Tarantino doesn't make Tarantino-style movies anymore.
Yeah, I agree. His movies don't feel like Tarantino films anymore. I think that may have to do with the fact that he's changed editors. I believe after, I forget which movie it was, but I think after Inglourious Basterds, or even for Inglourious Basterds, he changed editors. I don't know if it was for that one though, because that one to me still felt pretty Tarantino-ish, but Django Unchained definitely doesn't. It doesn't have that, because he loves his long shots, like, of people just, much like Kevin Smith, he likes having just a long continuous shot of a character, you know, putting out a monologue and holding on a very well lit angled shot, like especially in Pulp Fiction, like during the diner scene, the character's about to rob the place and it's like he's using natural sunlight for shading and whatnot, and it always holds on the character and lets them finish like an entire little speech or monologue or whatever. And you don't really see that with Django Unchained. It feels more close up, more, I guess, modern. There's a lot more cuts.
With the last couple of movies, he's been tamed a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's because of the changes. Like, he used to have a consistent editor for all of his movies, and he's recently changed that, and ever since he did, they're not bad. Like, I didn't hate Django Unchained. I enjoyed it enough.
I enjoyed both Django Unchained and Hateful Eight. They just didn't feel like 90s Tarantino anymore.
You know what happened?
Yeah, they don't.
Grindhouse.
Oh.
Grindhouse was a monumental failure, and it was probably the last movie that really felt like old Tarantino. After that was when he really kind of changed things up. I really think that that's kind of what was the turning point.
We were talking about long takes. What about like Paul Thomas Anderson? You know, if you're going into a PTA movie, it's going to have probably at least a half dozen shots where the camera follows somebody through a room, and it's a 5 or 6 minute uncut single take of something with music playing. That's one of that's a PTA staple, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you do notice that a lot in his movies. It's a little more subtle than some of the other filmmakers' tropes. Like there's some that are a lot more noticeable, like a Sergio Leone movie, for example. Like, you will have a lot of those shots where like it holds on a character's expression and like the way their eyes are squinting, and or they'll hold on like a piece of scenery or something like that. But with Paul Thomas's, it is kind of a thing where like you'll notice it every now and then, and you'll go, hey, this happened in the last movie of his that I watched. He must kind of like that shot.
A lot of they're really well done, just very long tracking shot. I'm a sucker for a good tracking shot, so I enjoy stuff like that. And we don't get With today's style of filmmaking, it's almost like the tracking shot is being phased out. And so whenever I see a movie that has one, I get all giddy because, like something like Children of Men, they fudged it. They were, it still looks like one, you know, amazing continuous tracking shot. And, so, you know, major kudos for trying to keep that alive.
Speaking of that, what about when a filmmaker fakes something like that, like the tracking shot? For instance, I love Contact. I think Contact is an amazing movie. When Robert Zemeckis directed that long, quote-unquote, tracking shot of Ellie hearing the signal, getting in her car, radioing the guys at the station, rushing back, rushing up all the stairs, it's one long, uncut, almost 5-minute shot until I listen to the commentary track. That's about a dozen different shots composited together with CGI to make them seem uncut. That actually kind of angers me that, you know, to find out that that, like, tracking shot was faked.
I don't know. I think that in the case of something like that, the logistics of putting that together are just astronomical, and making all of that work, you've worked in film, you know how hard it is. And to do that and then just, you know, to maybe get all the way close to the end and then have it blown one way or another, you know, I can understand why they wanted to do it, but they fudged it. So while I appreciate and I love a really good tracking shot and I love a legitimate tracking shot, I have more respect for when they do it. Something like that, I understand, because it's not easy to pull off. That's another reason why a lot of people don't do it.
Well, they call it movie magic for a reason. Sometimes editing just has to come into play.
What about when a director has a certain style that is so recognizable that, like with Peter Berg and Michael Bay, even their own protégés steal it? And I would look at Sam Raimi and Scott Spiegel. Because Sam Raimi's style, immediately noticeable. He loves his POV shots. And Sam Raimi is able to make those shots work. But then you look at the Scott Spiegel stuff. Remember, Scott Spiegel was his writing partner and producing partner on numerous movies. Everything Scott Spiegel has touched tries to do that same POV thing, but for some reason it doesn't work under Scott Spiegel. Have you guys noticed that Scott Spiegel tries to be Sam Raimi, but doesn't quite understand why Raimi picks the POV shots that he does? He has POV shots of everything. Every object has a POV shot.
Yeah,
that's not how Sam Raimi did it.
I forgot who directed. I actually thought Intruder was a Sam Raimi movie for a while, and I could see
why. Sam Raimi produced it.
Yeah, you could see why, because of all the POV shots. Like, I thought it was, wow, all these POV shots in a grocery store. This is kind of weird. Yeah, I can kind of see that he's sort of like a lesser Sam Raimi. It's sort of the same thing with the Platinum Dunes stuff, where they're all trying to ape Michael Bay, where they're using things in Michael Bay movies, but not really, no real reason for it. I can see that with movies like The Intruder. I haven't seen Hostel 3 or what was the other one? Dusk Till Dawn 2?
Dusk Till Dawn 2.
Yeah, don't see Dusk Till Dawn 2 or 3.
Hey, guys, we're going to be doing a retro on the From Dusk Till Dawns early next year, so we're going to have to sit regardless.
Well, shit. Okay. Well, until that time, I have not seen either Dusk Till Dawn 2 or Hostel 3, so I can't really comment on those. But on Intruder, yeah, thinking back to it, there is a lot of pointless POV in that movie now that I think about it.
I think that it's just he's worked together with him for so long, and he never really had the opportunity to develop his own style, so he just kind of went with what he was already familiar with. And I think that, you know, he's done good movies. I mean, I like Intruder, and I think Hostel 3 is actually really good. From Dusk Till Dawn 2 is absolute garbage, but I don't know. There might be some story behind that. It just rush production, or who knows, but it's awful. I think that he is a competent director, but I don't really think that he has a style. He's never really gotten out of Raimi. And that's a tough one, man, because could you imagine, you know, I mean, working, let's say you worked with somebody like Tarantino, and then you went off and you tried to do something, but you've been working with him for so long, and you kind of start, I mean, you're always going to be compared to him. And so I don't know. I mean, with something like with Raimi, he's worked with them, I mean, since they were in film school. It's just, I guess he's never really gotten beyond that. So, but his stuff is still good. You know, it's just, it's not Raimi. But even Raimi's stuff stinks now, unfortunately.
Let's look at a couple of people whose styles are different than what you would call their direction, where you look at the movie and it's not necessarily like camera angles or anything like that, like in a Tarantino or a Michael Bay or a Rob Zombie. It's all about just somehow the vibe they give off. I'm thinking like Steven Spielberg or Joe Dante or Terry Gilliam. You don't even need to, they don't have a specific like camera angle that they love. But for some reason, as soon as you go into a Joe Dante movie, it feels like a Joe Dante movie. A Steven Spielberg movie feels like a Steven Spielberg movie, even to the point of Poltergeist, when that's supposed to be a Tobe Hooper movie, there are parts where you're just like, wow, this feels like a Steven Spielberg movie. Terry Gilliam, his movies feel like a Terry Gilliam film. Mm-hmm. Just through and through. Yet you can't hit one's particular, well, that's because of this with these certain directors.
I actually just recently brings to mind Barry Sonnenfeld. Barry Sonnenfeld, he loves his zooms, like a lot of, like CG zooms. Like, I mean, it's still good, but you can kind of tell, like, it's a little off. Like, he did Men in Black. Fortunately, he did Wild Wild West, but, he's a good director. And, just recently, Nine Lives, and I'm watching it and I'm like, this feels kind of like Men in Black. And then at the end, I'm like, oh, I didn't even know Sonnenfeld. You know, I think they kind of had his name not really prominently on the movie. And, but it totally felt like a Sonnenfeld movie. So yeah, you have a lot of people who it's just the way that they do it. It just feels like one of their movies. Even though it necessarily doesn't have all of their earmarks, it's just something about it. Joe Dante, absolutely. Like every movie he does, it just has a certain vibe to it, a certain just feel that you know it's a Dante movie.
Absolutely agree with everything you guys have said about that. And another director I can bring up that fits that example is anytime I watch a Paul Verhoeven movie, I can always tell it's him. He has this, it's not even necessarily in the angle. I think it's just it's much like in the way Carpenter has a certain lens that he uses. There's always a certain vibe to a Paul Verhoeven film. It's in his film stock, Total Recall, RoboCop, even Starship Troopers. There's a certain grit to the film stock. There's something very grimy and dirty about the way, like Total Recall and RoboCop look, especially in RoboCop with like the urban environment and everything. Everything fits really well. And it just fits with the whole social satire and social commentary. Like he makes the world look like a very dirty, dirty place. And it fits with the type of stories that his films tell. Like, I've always really liked that about Verhoeven.
Well, and sometimes that can come down to maybe they found a cinematographer that they reuse a lot.
Yeah.
Like someone like Dean Cundey. It's really hard to quantify what Dean Cundey does, but you can immediately look at a movie and you're like, this was shot by Dean Cundey. It's he uses a lot of light reflecting off things. Everything feels very wet. Even if it's a movie set in the desert, somehow it has like a moisture to it, if that makes any sense. Am I making sense? Do you guys understand what I mean by you can immediately go, Dean Cundey shot this?
Yeah.
And, you know, so sometimes it is the cinematographer, and other times there are just certain things that pop up. For instance, like Lucio Fulci. You know, if you're watching a Lucio Fulci film, he doesn't have a signature style so much as he has tropes that he brings up. If you're watching a Fulci film, somebody's getting something in their eye in a disturbing close-up.
And the cinematography is going to be very pretty and soft focus looking when it happens.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Cause like, even when he does something outside of his wheelhouse, like, even something like Conquest has eye damage to it. Or even when he did a Western like Massacre Time with Franco Nero, a guy gets a whip in the eye. You start to go, are you working something out here, Fulci? You seem to have a thing for eyes.
I think it's more so that it's what's effective. Like, I mean, I cringe when there's somebody getting something in their eye. And I think that he just knows that that's really effective. I mean, and so he goes with it. So, and I don't know. I mean, maybe he just really enjoys that because he knows it wigs people out. What am I going to do this time? I'm going to stick something in somebody's eye this way.
I think he just knows that it, as Cecil said, he knows that it wigs people out. He knows that it's something that a lot of people look at and are just mortified and disgusted by it, because that's the type of filmmaker he is. He knows exactly what he does. He was an incredibly talented filmmaker. His movies look amazing. When it all comes down to it, he was like mainly a horror and exploitation guy. And what's more, like, almost nothing is more horrific and exploitive than like seeing this eye get completely mutilated, like in a lot of his movies do, like in New York Ripper with the razor blade, or in Zombie with the sharp piece of like wood from the door getting rammed into a chick's eye. He just knows how to make people feel queasy and disgusted, because of course he would. He was a talented exploitation and horror filmmaker. He knows what he's doing.
What about somebody like John Woo? You know, a John Woo movie, there's going to be a gunfight with doves in the background. It's just going to happen, you know?
Dual handguns.
Yep. Yes, it'll have dual handguns.
Dual handgun Mexican standoffs.
With doves.
With doves, yeah.
You know, but then you have other ones who are harder to quantify, like David Lynch. David Lynch, all of his movies are so different, yet you immediately go, that's David Lynch. See, unlike with like Joe Dante, Lynch's style is a little more esoteric, but yet still feels Lynchian. I think some filmmakers lose that, like to go back to Fulci. You know, Fulci was more comfortable with horror, but he also directed sci-fi movies like The New Gladiators. He directed Conquest, which was a fantasy movie. And I like both those movies. They don't feel like Fulci, like Massacre Time. It's a straight up Western. It doesn't feel like Fulci all of a sudden. You think some directors just kind of need to stay within a certain genre?
I wouldn't say that they need to stay in a certain genre, but I mean, there are certain directors that just work better in that genre. It's the genre that they're more passionate about. So it just is what works for them. So I don't know. I mean, I think that every director deserves to branch out and try new things. You never know what you might be able to achieve. You might be able to learn from trying a different genre. I mean, if you want to stick with one genre and it's what works for you, fine. But if you want to try new things, they should absolutely be able to do that. I mean, that's what has screwed a lot of directors' abilities to grow over, is that they do one type of movie, it ends up being a really big hit, and then they can't get production to do any other type of movie. Hey, I just did a horror movie, and now I want to do a comedy. Well, we don't want a comedy from somebody who's a horror guy. It's like, well, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, let them try different things. Let them grow and learn. You know, unless they, you know, they want to stick with one thing, fine. If they want to grow, let them.
I just kind of look at it as like, who was asking for a Lucio Fulci Western?
Eh, but why not? You know?
It could have been cool.
He could have been burning himself out. You know, maybe he was tired of doing horror and he wanted, you know, he had a dream to do a Western and he did a Western.
It was actually, okay, here's the thing about Massacre Time. It was actually a good movie. It just didn't feel like a Fulci movie is my only complaint.
It felt more, felt a lot more like Sergio Leone. Like that's kind of what he was aping with
it,
that.
It really did, especially with Franco Nero in that it just, I don't know, it felt more like a Django movie. And I don't mean that just because of Franco Nero. I mean, even the character Nero plays is like a Django knockoff.
I think some directors can really do that well. Like Joel Schumacher seems to be comfortable with almost any type of movie. Like he's made teen dramas like St. Elmo's Fire. He's made like comedy horrors like The Lost Boys. Serious social commentary black humor movies like Falling Down. He's made comic book movies like fucking Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, which say what you will about those movies, they look cool as comic book films. They're very colorful and bright and bombastic.
And you know what? You know what? His best movie is A Time to Kill.
Yeah, like I think
that's a fantastic movie, and it kind of shocks me that he made that right after Batman and Robin.
Yeah, he's a really subversive filmmaker. Like he doesn't seem to have a style that you can completely pinpoint. And a lot of people, I think, see that as like he's untalented or something. But to me, I feel like he's really versatile and he can make just about any film. Like Falling Down is one of my favorite movies ever. I show that to as many people as I can. Same with Lost Boys and same with St. Elmo's Fire. All three of them feel like they could have been directed by different people. Like just because you can get Joel Schumacher to make just about any film and do it really, not just well, but like exceptional, like fantastic, like really, really well. Whereas with somebody like Lucio Fulci, and it's not a bad thing, just some directors are better with one certain genre. Fulci definitely excels in horror and slasher, weird voodoo zombie stuff. Like that's what he's good at. He's good at, zombie mad scientists that, you know, live in the basement of a house and perform experiments or, you know, stuff like that or serial killers in New York. He's good with that stuff. Not to say that his other movies are bad. Like I actually really enjoy Conquest. Conquest feels a lot more like a Fulci movie than Massacre Time does. It does sort of feel like, you know, taking a sort of, you know, fantasy, like warriors and wizards type movie, but then infusing it with like trash film, Z grade stuff. Like it's a very,
it has blue neon laser arrows. That's awesome.
Yeah. As blue neon lasers and a character gets gangrene, like you don't get more Fulci than that. It would be more perfect if he got gangrene on his eye. But with a guy like Fulci, yeah, I mean, yeah, horror is more his thing, and it's not a bad thing. That's just what he excels at. His movies are still entertaining, but he's not a Schumacher. We can put it that way. He can't quite go out and make like any sort of genre. That goes for maybe Verhoeven as well. Like Verhoeven's good with social commentary action films. Not so great with movies about strippers.
Let's stick with the Italians for a sec. When a director has a certain style and another director doesn't try to ape it, but bounces off of that and still creates his own style off of that. And I'm looking at Dario Argento to Richard Stanley. Because Argento has a very unique lighting style. Argento's lighting is always so dynamic, it usually never makes sense in the plot where this lighting would be coming from, but it looks so great you don't care. When Richard Stanley started out, like when he was making Hardware, he told his DP, I want this to look like an Argento film. Lighting-wise, it does, but Richard Stanley had enough of his own style that he wasn't coming across like an Argento clone. Cause you, just like, I mean, Richard Stanley's only made a couple of movies, but all of them feel like Richard Stanley. They don't feel like an Argento clone, but you can see Argento's influence. Is that like where Richard Stanley got it, where Scott Spiegel and Peter Berg didn't understand properly?
Thing with, with Hardware, the reason why it's not so much Argento-ish, because a lot of Argento's movies are very gothic. They deal with, witches and paranormal things and violent murderers and stuff like that. So when that weird like green and blue and red neon shows up, it kind of does show up for no reason, because his movies tend to take place in like countryside or in like the middle of Italy, country picturesque parts. So it's like
it makes no sense in Suspiria why it's lit like that, but it's so gorgeous you stop caring.
Exactly. Whereas with Hardware, it actually makes sense. It takes place in like a dystopian future. It takes place in like a 2000 AD dystopia where you've got like computers and weird lights and robots trying to kill people. It kind of makes sense that there would be this like red and blue neon and stuff. So yeah, he went out to do this like tribute to Argento, but then in a lot of ways ended up kind of coming up with his own thing, because his was more of a futuristic story, and it actually made sense for the film. So it makes it feel less like an Argento movie and more like an original Richard Stanley film, with his take on like a 2000 AD storyline. So it is kind of weird when that happens, but it's awesome that it happens, because then it sort of does builds like an original look for the director, even though he originally started out doing a tribute to another guy.
And I think that goes even further into Dust Devil. You can really see again the Argento influence on the movie, yet it still is completely Stanley's style.
Well, I mean, it kind of goes in the same way that people who start, they pick up a guitar and they really like Eddie Van Halen. They learn how to playing Eddie Van Halen songs. But then when they go off and they start their own band, they sound, you know, they develop their own style and play. And I think that that's the same with Richard Stanley. He grew up and he loved and admired with Argento. He liked that style. He learned from that. And then when he started working and made his own, he kind of developed his own style, but still wanted to throw in a little bit of that flavor in there, but had enough of his own talent that he made it his own.
And unfortunately, that doesn't happen as often. Specifically wants to say f*** you to the establishment and directs a film intentionally, not just outside of their own style, outside of the norm. For instance, William Friedkin is a stalwart director. He doesn't necessarily have a style, but you can count on him to make a good film. Even if you don't like the final product, it's well made. Then you look at like To Live and Die in LA, and he directed that movie, and he confirmed that, I noticed this, but he confirmed it on the commentary track, that he directed this movie like he didn't know how to direct a movie. Cause you know how there's normal like a shot reverse shot. the actor who's talking is the one who's in frame, and then they do the reverse shot. He shot it the opposite. The actor who's talking is whose back of the head we're seeing, so we're seeing the reactions of the person they're talking to. Instead of, say, like when William Peterson's truck pulls up to the strip club, normally you'd see the truck pull up, and then it would cut to him going inside, and then the dialogue would start. Whereas Friedkin shot this showing you the truck pulling up, him getting out, shutting the door, walking in the door, and then staying on the outside of the building while the dialogue begins on the inside. He shot this movie specifically to see if he could shoot a movie that was breaking all of the tropes of how you shoot a movie. Mm. And it really gives that movie an off-kilter tone, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's great, because I think that it's showing that he's trying to do some things differently, and I respect that. Now,
if you didn't know better, you'd think he didn't know how to direct a movie, wouldn't you?
Well, it's not so much that you don't know, but I mean, like, believe me, there's a difference between breaking the usual tropes and the things that work as far as directorial wise and being James Nguyen and making Birdemic. You know, that's somebody who doesn't know how to direct a movie. Like, what he
Fair
did
enough.
Was something that was being experimental. He was trying, you know, to do the opposite. He was trying to do things differently, seeing what worked and what didn't work. And it's amazing that he got the opportunity to do that, because I have a feeling these days you would not be able to do that. You'd start doing that, the studio would see the dailies, they'd panic and pull you off and throw somebody else in there.
Shows the talent in a director to be able to do something completely considered wrong by the industry and still make a really kick-ass movie. And it's not something you're really going to see in too many established directors nowadays. Like, nowadays everybody is trying to make their movie as polished and as stylized as possible, unless it's like a found footage film. And even then, like, it's very booming and stylistic, and it tries to be as dark and as gritty as possible. You're only really going to find more experimental filmmakers nowadays in more of the independent scene. You're going to find it more guys like Nicholas Winding Refn and guys that are, I can't remember the name of the director, but it's I can list off movies like Cold in July, movies like Green Room. These are a lot more experimental, you know, just taking concepts like a punk band getting stranded somewhere, then a bunch of skinheads try to kill them and whatnot, and turning it into like a slasher film. There's a lot of really cool experimental indie films out there, and they're probably not gonna end up being looked at as blockbuster films, and that's both unfortunate on one hand, but I also kind of like it. I was talking with Dustin about this just the other night, and I was like wanting to see more experimental films in theaters. Then he was like, well, honestly, it's better, because when you have blockbusters, the directors are usually have their hands tied. They usually get their movies completely blasted in post-production and ripped apart. Whereas when you have these indie filmmakers with more modest incomes and modest budgets, they have their complete freedom and they can make whatever movie they want to make. And honestly, I like that. I like that I can go see a movie like The Guest or Cold in July or Blue Ruin or Only God Forgives. And that's exactly the type of movie that the filmmaker wanted to make. They wanted to shoot it a certain way. They wanted to write it a certain way. That's why the independent film scene is such a goldmine, because you're going to get a lot of those types of experimental films like To Live and Die in LA was.
Like a certain director where their visual style is so unique that it's almost become a crutch. Like Wes Anderson. I don't like Wes Anderson's movies. He is almost bound by Wes Anderson tropes to the point where it's almost like he just stopped caring. Like Tim Burton. Every Tim Burton movie feels like Tim Burton, but it also feels like Tim Burton gave up.
Yeah, they clearly began to stagnate, whether they meant to, or maybe it is just stagnating, actually. It seems like that for Tim Burton. Like, he found a certain style, and then he just kept ripping himself off over and over and over again until it just got ridiculous. Like, the Alice in Wonderland movie is just a joke. I'm not even going to see the sequel. It's kind of sad to see that happen. Like, a director kind of lose that passion and that fire to really make a great movie, and they just kind of fall into this safe zone where it's like, well, this worked in last couple of movies, I'll just kind of mimic this, I'll kind of get the same actors and do the same thing again. I think it's unfortunate, because I really do like a lot of Tim Burton's earlier movies. You know, I love Beetlejuice, I love Batman, I even really like Sleepy Hollow. I think Sleepy Hollow is his like really last true good movie, and then he kind of began to stagnate. Wes Anderson, I don't really give a f*** about either way. I've never really cared for him as a director. I think he's definitely popular with the hipster crowd and whatnot. But he does, from the movies of his that I've seen, he does pretty much do the same plinkety shit. I liked Fantastic Mr. Fox, though, just for the... That one was kind of different just because he went for with stop frame, and I'm always a sucker for stop frame animation and whatnot. But other than that, either I don't really care either way. I think I'm more concerned with directors like James Cameron not giving as much of a shit anymore. Like when you compare something like Avatar to even like True Lies or you know Terminator 2 or the first one, it's kind of sad to see how, especially with his ego, like he really thinks he's this like incredible filmmaker, and he is. Much of his movies are. Comparing Avatar to a lot of his earlier works, to something like Aliens or to the first Terminator movie, is just like, what the f*** happened, man? Like, what happened to the movie magic, dude?
I don't know what happened with Tim Burton. That one really hurts because Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, Batman, Batman Returns, Ed Wood, Mars Attacks, like some of my favorite movies, and they all have a very distinct style, and they are very Tim Burton. And then, like Peter said, he did the Sleepy Hollow, which is really good, and then after that, he just started going downhill, and all of his movies were either remakes or adaptations of something. Like, he wasn't doing, now I realize Batman and Batman Returns and Mars Attacks were adaptations. You know, his stuff, it just had a certain feel to it, and it was just genuine. And
you also know a Tim Burton trope. It will have Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter in it. No matter whether they're miscast or not, they're gonna be in it.
You know, post 2000, you know, I mean, it really wasn't, Ed Wood was, so it was 94, but he didn't really become like the constant guy until, 2000 and on. So, yeah, but now it's always gonna have Helena Bonham Carter and Johnny Depp. And I'm kind of on the fence about that because it's like, okay, well, you are constantly including two very talented actors. Even Kevin Smith has branched out and has gotten like, you know, other people, and like he has people that are in his movies that are in all of his movies, but they're not always like the front people. They're not always the main star. Like,
but to be fair, lots of directors do that. Paul Thomas Anderson, Carpenter, Tarantino, Michael Bay, Spielberg, they use the same supporting casts over and over, but they realize they're supporting casts.
That's the thing. You realize who your supporting cast is. And sometimes, you know, you throw them a bone, you put them in a, you know, you take like Ben Affleck and you put him at the front of Chasing Amy. You know, you recognize, you know, who, you know, hey, this guy's going to work. And you know, but with Burton, it's just like, okay, Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter are always going to be the main stars of the movie. And then it gets really old and really annoying. And it just, I don't know. I don't know what happened with him. Like, I don't know if it's just that he sees what works and he just keeps doing it, or because the thing is, I mean, people, they want it, obviously. His movies are, you know, fucking, I hated Alice in Wonderland, but it made $1 billion.
Wow.
So, you know, it's...
But then again, Dark Shadows was a complete bomb, as it deserved to be.
But I mean, they're willing to kind of overlook if your last movie made $1 billion. So, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with him. If he just doesn't care, or if, you know, that creative spark just isn't there, or if there's maybe so much pressure to perform, you know, there's so much pressure to make the next movie that makes $1 billion that he keeps following the formula that previously worked. Oh, and I like Wes Anderson. Wes Anderson, for the most part, he sticks with like smaller, you know, experimental films. He does have a lot of the same styles that he goes by. There's a lot of chatting. There's a lot of quirkiness. And unfortunately, it has kind of been absconded by hipsters. But I like his stuff. It's movies that I usually can watch once, maybe twice, and, you know, not watch again. But I appreciate them. And I think that overall, I think that he's good. I don't think that he's really I wouldn't say that he's in the same vein as like Tim Burton. Like, at least he's still doing oddball, you know, unique stuff.
You hire a director with a signature style, and then the entire production tell them not to use their style. This happens a lot in television. For instance, Rob Zombie and Joe Dante both said they had almost zero control when they worked on the various CSIs. And Tarantino said almost the same thing. When he did his CSIs, but he got more control than Rob Zombie or Joe Dante did, but it was, no, we want your name, but you have to make it in the style of our episode. And you get certain movies like that, where all of a sudden you'll hire a director with a signature style and then go, but we want you to make it like this. And you go, then why did you hire that director?
With a TV show, it makes sense because show has its, like, flavor, and that's what the audience wants. And then they'll bring in, like, a specific director, and they'll want him to direct it, but then they want him to direct it a certain way. I don't know. I guess they don't want it to go too far outside of what it normally is.
Rob Zombie said his CSI Miami episode was the worst 2 weeks he's had in his professional career.
I don't know. You get some directors, like going back to Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith did a story arc on Degrassi, and he was allowed, you know, to kind of do it the way that he wanted. And I guess it's such a smaller show, you know, they give them that freedom. A juggernaut like CSI, or I think, although with ER, like, I know Tarantino directed one, like, didn't they kind of let them have a little bit more of the, you know, of their own control to do it?
Yeah, now Tarantino's CSI did feel like Tarantino. His ER did as well.
I don't see the point. I get that they're big shows and that they would, like, confine them creatively, and that they would have to sort of go by the confines of the giant show. But in that case, it's kind of obvious what they're doing. They just want a big name. They want to be able to say, oh, you're directed by Quentin Tarantino. But if it doesn't look like that director's style, what's the point? Like, that's what I loved about Tales from the Crypt, is that they would always get this guest director, and the episode would be made like one of their films, like the Joe Dante directed episodes and stuff like that. There's his color and style. And I think that's awesome when you have an anthology show. But if it's a show that has its own, you know, specific style, maybe don't do it if you're not going to actually let the director do their thing. I don't really see the point. I think it's hollow, and I think it really shows the greed of the showrunners, just being like, okay, well, we're just going to get this big name attached to it, and more people are going to watch the episode. Who fucking cares if it doesn't look like one of their movies? That's shady, and I don't like it.
What are your final thoughts on director's styles? Do you think that we're kind of losing this? Because you'll notice almost everyone that we brought up tonight is from maybe 1995 and below, where they started their career. Do you think that directors with eminently unique styles is kind of going by the wayside? Yes, you've got the Wes Andersons and the Rob Zombies who have a distinct style all their own, but in general, do you think a director having a signature style is becoming more rare?
Yeah, when you look at the majority of trailers now, or even just movies in general, like, it's just product. They don't, you could watch a bunch of movies and not really have any idea who the directors are. Now, every now and then you'll start to get, we're getting some breakout directors that have a very unique style, and they're going to go on to, you know, greater things. But the vast majority of the stuff that's hitting the multiplexes, the stuff that's really going mainstream, are a lot of directors that are churning out shit that anybody could have done. You know, there's no flair, there's no originality, there's nothing that couldn't have been done by somebody else. John Moore, how the hell is that guy still working? Every freaking movie he's done was Behind Enemy Lines, box office bomb. Flay of the Phoenix, bomb. The Omen, bomb. Max Payne, bomb. Oh, so what do they do? Hey, here's $1 billion franchise. Why don't you do the next good, you know, Die Hard? And what happens? It's the most disliked of all the Die Hards.
Only in Hollywood can you fail upwards.
But then you have directors that come along that are really good. Somebody like Richard Stanley, he has like one movie that kind of goes off the rails because the studio panicked.
It wasn't his fault.
It wasn't his fault, and he gets ostracized. Meanwhile, you got a guy who's made bomb after bomb, and he keeps getting bigger and bigger movies.
It's Chinatown, man.
It's Chinatown. Forget it, Jake.
I think if you want to find truly unique directors nowadays, as I said, you really got to look in the independent scene. You'll find some really great stuff from guys like Adam Weingart. You'll find some really great stuff from, and I'm probably going to butcher his name, Jeremy Saulnier. Or Nier, he made Green Room, he made Blue Ruin. He makes some really cool movies. Guys like Nicholas Refn, you're going to find some truly unique stuff. When it comes to the Hollywood stuff, you'll get some cool blockbusters here and there. You know, The Revenant was awesome. Pain and Gain is great, but it's really a few and far between thing. If you really want to find some consistently unique stuff, you got to look for a lot of the stuff that's not being advertised quite as much, that's going to be direct to video, that's going to be direct to Netflix. You might be surprised. It's going to be some good shit.
You've also got the up-and-comers like David Irons and people like that who are learning the craft and developing their own styles that are going to be someone to watch out for. So on that note, Peter Gojek's style can be seen where?
It can be seen on Twitter at Cinematica, on Facebook, The Cinemasochist, on YouTube, The Cinemasochist, and on 1201beyond.com, and on the GrindhouseChannel.com.
Where can Cecil be located?
I can be located on escapistmagazine.com, goodbadflix.com, and all your favorite social media outlets.
I can be located at 1201beyond.com, where you'll see my style. Contact this show at 1201beyond@gmail.com, and I'm also writing for the Grindhouse Channel. I'm also writing for Fangoria Magazine, and Hustler Magazine, and ForcesOfGeek.com, and Nightflight.com. You know, with all the writing I do, I actually should be able to make a living at this. This sucks.
This is what you want, this is what you get. This is what you want, this is what you get. This is what you want, this is what you get. This is what you want, this is what you get. This is what you want, this is what you get.
We'll be right back.
this is what you want, this is what you get, this is what you want, this is what you get, this is what you want, this is what you get, this is what you want, this is what you get, this is what you want, this is what you get, this is what you want, this is what you get, this is what you want, this is what you get, this is what you get.
Radiodrome is a 1201 Beyond production. Find it and other great content at 1201beyond.com.